Good afternoon, everyone.
Ooh, a little bit louder than I thought it was going to be.
I'm Keith Steinbaugh. I'm the president this year of the Alaska World Affairs Council. I want to welcome you to our presentation today. And before we get started with some of the administrative announcements, I want to say a special welcome to one of our guests. Barbara Propst is here. Barbara's a former executive director here as well as national president. And Barbara, it's good to see you back. Hopefully all of you had a chance to purchase a raffle ticket for the wonderful Great Harvest Bread Basket. If you didn't, there's still a few minutes left over there on the table. I want to remind you that we're a membership organization, and since this is the new program year, membership from last year has expired, so if you haven't renewed your membership, please do so, and that's very crucial for our support. We're also delighted to announce the continuation of a student program that we have. Totem Ocean Trailer Express is sponsoring grants for student memberships right now, so if you're a student and you're interested, please see Lisa or someone at the table and they can help you with that. And on that note, do we have any students that are present today? Please stand up and tell us what school you're from. What's UAA?
No, I'm actually from
South Anchorage, UAA. And well, thank you and welcome. I want to say thanks to all of our sponsoring organizations, especially BP, who sponsors the meals for our students at each of our programs. I want to say thanks to William Toyer today for recording us for KSKA. William's one of our board members, and he works making sure that our programs can be on the air for podcasts later. Also want to say that we have the 2010 Great Decision Books in. They're available right now for $18. A lot of good topics in here this time. Russia and its neighbors, the Persian Gulf, financial crisis, special envoys. So if you're interested in that, please pick up a copy at the table. And now, if we could, I'd like to do our bread basket drawing. And I would like to ask our guest speaker, General Frazier, if you would, to draw the winning ticket. Okay, the number is 583594. There you go.
All right.
And now I'd like to introduce the head table. To my immediate left is General Frazier, who will be introduced in a minute as our speaker. We have Lisa Falsco, who is the executive director of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and Rod Finkel, who is a former president of the World Affairs Council, as well as former board member. And Rod's going to be introducing our speaker today. Rod.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It was 9 years ago when I first had the pleasure of meeting our guest speaker. He was, at the time, the wing commander at Elmendorf Air Force Base. We lost him temporarily, but he was returned to us as Commander, Alaska Command, U.S. Pacific Command, Commander, 11th Air Force, Pacific Air Forces, and Commander, Alaska North American Defense Region. He was then assigned and served as Deputy Commander, U.S. Pacific Command. He now serves as Commander, U.S. Southern Command, and he is the first Air Force officer to do so. General Frazier, welcome back. Our guest speaker was born April 16th in 1953. He earned his commission upon graduation from the United States Air Force Academy in 1975. He has distinguished himself as an officer of high potential in every duty assignment, which has brought him to the highest levels of command and as a senior officer in the United States Air Force. He is a command pilot with over 2,700 hours of flying, mostly in F-15 and F-16 type aircraft. He has attended advanced studies at the Air Command and General Staff College, the National War College, and the Joint Flag Officer War Fighting Course. He earned his master's degree in political science from Auburn University. He's been awarded many decorations for his achievements. Some of these include the Defense Distinguished Service Medal, the Air Force Distinguished Service Medal, the Defense Superior Service Medal with two oak leaf clusters. That means he's earned it twice. He's earned the Legion of Merit, the Meritorious Service Medal with three oak leaf clusters, and the Air Force Achievement Medal. He has many additional awards. Please join me in extending the warmest welcome to a distinguished officer and an old friend of Alaska and the World Affairs Council, General Fraser.
Thanks, Rod. I think I can summarize that by saying I'm an old guy. Well, to some of us in the room, that may not be the case, but it really is a great privilege for me to be back in Alaska, back in the great land. It's been a couple of years since I had the privilege of being here. We have fond memories of our time here. We looked forward often to coming back, and so it's great to see a lot of old friends, former friends, current friends, all those things here as we talk about this. I also want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you about a part of the world that a lot of us, I would argue, don't pay a lot of attention to within the United States, and I think that's unfortunate. I have a connection, and you heard my Air Force bio, but I have a connection to the region that I now serve in or serve with because I spent high school, 3 years of high school, sophomore through senior, in Columbia, in Bogota, Colombia, and graduated. And so I have a great affinity for the people of Latin America and Latin America. And so it really has been, for me, a dream come true to come all the way back around from my roots living in Latin America in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and now have an opportunity to serve in a very different capacity, obviously, than I did back at that time. So what I want to do is a couple of things this afternoon. One is give you a broad understanding of what U.S. Southern Command does and how we view the region in which I'm responsible for directing U.S. military forces and our interaction with our partner militaries. And then I thought I'd take an opportunity to share our experiences with relief operations in response to the earthquake in Haiti this past January. I thought you might find that interesting also, especially since Alaska is an earthquake-prone area also, just so that you have an understanding of what we saw there. And I'll share a couple of lessons with you. So with that, this is the area of which I'm responsible, 1/6 of the Earth's surface. It includes Central America, the Caribbean, and South America. It does not include Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, the Turks and Caicos, and the Bahamas, nor Mexico. Those are all part of U.S. Northern Command's responsibility. Now, I say that, but I think it's important to understand that that line is a very, very gray line. And we work very, very closely day in, day out with U.S. Northern Command regarding our responsibilities there. You see a lot of the demographics there, 31 countries. Of emphasis from my standpoint is a lot of times when we say Latin America, we think Spanish speaking, and we think because everybody speaks Spanish, that everybody is a homogeneous region and they all see the world in the same manner. And I'm here to tell you there are 31 different countries, there are 10 protectorates, and they are all individual nations, and they all have their own issues, their own geography, their own concerns. And so we deal with them very much on a bilateral basis, where it makes sense, on a multilateral base where it makes sense, and that's important to do that. You can see that almost half the people in the region are Portuguese speakers, and Brazil is a very up-and-coming power within not only the region, but in the world, and that has an important influence also. You can see also some of the other just economic linkages that we have. The Panama Canal still remains a very important infrastructure for the United States, and the canal right now has a $4 or $5 billion project that will be completed in 2014 to build another part to the canal that can handle the large super tankers and large ships that come through. So that will also increase that utility. The second largest user of the Panama Canal is China. And China and companies of China operate the ports on both ends of the canal zone. So China also has a significant interest in the region as well. You can also see the remittances from all those people from Latin descent who live in the United States and send money back. It's a pretty significant part, and in parts of Central America that equates to about 10% of their GDP. So it has a very significant impact as you look at those immigrants in the area. If you look at the connections that we have, we're the fifth largest Spanish-speaking country in the world. And you see that by 2050, one-third of our population will be Spanish-speaking or have a connection with Latin America. If you look at the 10 most popular surnames in the United States today, four of those have Hispanic origins. So we have a great connection, a great affinity, a great cultural relationship with the region, but a lot of times our focus is east-west and not north-south. And so a lot of connections, a lot of great people, and a lot of people within the region who still look to the United States, but they're also nowadays starting to look globally, much like everybody else is. In a global world, in an information world, everybody is looking for those opportunities worldwide on where they can prosper and how they can increase their capabilities. There are some challenges. Poverty remains a serious concern within the region. One-third of the people in Latin America live at the poverty level, less than $2 a day of income. 16% of those, or I take that back, 13% of those people live at extreme poverty, $1 a day. And so that has its own endemic problems as you look at it. You then look at the income inequality, 10% of the population of the region owns 48% of the wealth. And the other side of it is difficult, and it's hard to move back and forth between those income distributions. And so that also now puts an impact in the region. You look at it from a social class standpoint. As I said, it's very difficult to move from one class to another. A lot of that has to do with just historical norms. Just because of Spanish heritage and European heritage as they were growing, a lot of the strongmen kind of capabilities that were resident within South America during colonial times, and a lot of those still continue on. And then corruption remains a significant event. And that's what this map is intended to do. Countries with low corruption are normally on a scale of about 5 and above. And you can see there's only about 7 countries in the region that have a corruption indices to that level. And it goes down from there. So all these things take away from the ability of each country's economic engines and societal engines being able to produce. And it also provides an opportunity for those organizations, those entities who want to cause some disruption and some concerns to have a fertile ground in which to operate. And I'll talk more about that here in a minute. I guess I can do the next. So here's our vision. We are a joint and interagency organization. By joint, we have, like most of the combatant commands do, we have components from each one of the services. So we have an Air Force component, that's in Tucson, Arizona. We have an Army component in San Antonio, a Navy component near Jacksonville, Florida, a Marine component, just the headquarters that's right in Miami where our headquarters is, and then a Special Ops Command component, which is, again, in the South Florida area. But we also have a lot of interagency representatives. In fact, I have a civilian deputy who is a former ambassador. He's a Department of State employee, and he provides a lot of good interaction and support. But we have national intelligence organizations represented. We have DEA, FBI, USAID, Agency for International Development. A lot of those organizations that we need to work with from an intergovernmental standpoint, we work with those people, and they're integrated into our headquarters staff. In addition to that, we have liaison officers from some of the countries in the region who work on our staff also, just to make sure we have good connections that way. And so our job is supporting U.S. security interests, focused on security, stability, and prosperity in the Americas. And that's our job. So what's our mission? To be able to conduct joint, again, within the United States, we term that joint where we're working with all the services, and combined when we're working with other partner militaries for a full spectrum of military operations. And I say full spectrum because we need to have the capacity to be able to conduct conventional military capability, but we also need to be able to support the counter-terrorist, the counter-illicit trafficking activities that we conduct within the region. And again, a whole of government efforts supported on security and cooperation. The pictures you see here are just examples of the various things we're involved with. We do a lot of humanitarian assistance, medical programs, and that's what you see here. We do some experimental work trying to see what the value of remotely piloted systems is. And so this is actually an Israeli capability being flown out of an airfield in El Salvador. We do joint training. This is with some Marines in Brazil, if I remember right. This is working with our Dominican Republic partners. This is the U.S. Coast Guard intercepting a go-fast boat illicit trafficker in a simulated effort. And this is the Peruvian Air Force with the U.S. Air Force operating out of Hill Air Force Base in Utah. Next. So here's our challenges. The first thing I want to say is I do not see, and my job is to defend the United States, the southern approaches to the United States. I do not see a conventional military threat to the United States from Latin America, the Caribbean. I really don't see a conventional military threat nation to nation within the region. So from that standpoint, the security challenges are a little non-traditional from what you would normally think of from a combatant command. And so those equate to, as you see, illicit trafficking. And by illicit trafficking, I mean drugs, weapons, bulk cash, human, exotic animals, all types of illicit trafficking impact the region, and they undermine the security and stability depending on where you go. And examples of that can be Colombia, and a lot of people over a number of years have focused on that. Mexico obviously has a lot of interest from our nation right now just because of Southwest borders, but it's a problem throughout the region. I'll show you that more in a minute. Narco-terrorism, there are two groups that we recognize as narco-terrorist groups within the region right now. One of them is the FARC in Colombia, and the other is a group called Sendero Luminoso in Peru. And so those are the two groups that have had terrorist or governmental change, philosophical issues, but a lot of them are being financed now through illicit trafficking efforts. And so there is really a narco-terrorist opportunity there. A lot of countries are also starting to look at, from the illicit trafficking issue, where does that bridge into what they would consider terrorist-like activities? Because some of the practices of these illicit groups, even though they don't profess a philosophy, they still conduct their operations in a terrorist-like method. And so the definition between counter-narcotics and counter-terrorism is a very blurry definition as it gets applied in some of the countries within the region. Gangs are becoming a problem within Central America especially, and that's one of the exports that has come from the United States. A lot of those immigrants that we have put in prisons in the United States have become gang members within the United States, and then when we deport them back to their countries, they now take that expertise that they learned in our prisons and they apply that in the region. So there's over 100,000 gang members in the northern part of Central America right now, in large amount, I would argue, an export from the United States. And so that's a growing problem as you look at that connection. We look and concerned about the potential for mass migration. This is a boat of what a freighter and people trying to get out of Haiti would look like. The last time we had a really significant portion of mass migration was in 1994, but it is still a potential just because of the endemic conditions that exist in Haiti. And then natural disasters remain one of those things that we focus on continuously. Again, our focus is on secure, stable, and democratic organizations. Next. I can do that. Okay, so this is the thing that I'm concerned about the most. And it's the enterprise, it's the cycle of illicit trafficking. And let me help underscore this. Our estimates, and they run from $320 billion to $394 billion a year as a global enterprise. That's a lot of money. And that gives a huge amount of capacity to these organizations. The cause of all that is drug use in the United States. Our national drug policy now focuses very much on public health and trying to work to reduce the demand for drugs by focusing on the cost to our own public health that drugs cause within our nation. But it's not only there. European market is growing. Right now, Spain is the highest per capita user of cocaine in the world. And the markets are growing in the Far East or in the Middle East. A kilo of cocaine in Colombia, if you sold it there, would be about $2,500 for a kilo. You bring it into the United States, it runs $20,000 to about $40,000 per kilo. You take it to Europe, it runs $70,000 to $100,000 per kilo. Into the Middle East, it runs into the $100,000 to $140,000 per kilo. So that gives you an idea of the return, if you will, for just a kilo and why it's such a lucrative business. 95% of the cocaine in the world, and I talk about cocaine because that's what we know the most about, but there are a lot of other drugs moving around, marijuana, methamphetamines, heroin, a lot of those types of drugs are still out also. 95% is produced here. You can see how they normally traffic this, and what's happening is Colombia is still the largest producer, but it's really northern part of South America, because Peru has now become, according to the UN, the largest producer of coca leaf, not of cocaine, but of coca leaf. And so the Colombian efforts have been successful, and the traffickers are moving other places. That's what that demonstrates, because the cocaine production in Colombia has been coming down over the last 2 years pretty significantly. So that all gets produced here, and then it transits up through the Caribbean, through Central America. This gives you an idea in 2009 what that looks like. So it emanates, it comes across the border into Venezuela, and then they fly air tracks up through Hispaniola or over to Honduras, Guatemala, and that's where they go into. About 20% of the traffic goes by air. The other parts of it go through the maritime means, about 80% of it. So again, they go to places on the coast and then work into Central America, come on land and move up through the region. We found when we really originally started this that most of the traffic back 10, 15 years ago was air-based and was flying directly into the United States. And so we had an organization that was set up, Joint Interagency Task Force South, that started addressing that. And it's an interagency organization. And they started stopping that. We also put a program into effect in Colombia called an Air Bridge Denial Program, which, as you can tell, significantly cut down on the air traffic leaving Colombia. So the traffickers adjusted, and they started going much more to the maritime environment. It used to be Mexico was the number one place that drugs entered the system before they off the maritime and got onto land. Now it's coming down closer to Panama because we're being effective in the maritime interdiction. And so the traffickers are adjusting. They come on land. Now we have to work on a bilateral basis. They get on the Pan-American Highway and they move up the Central American Isthmus into Mexico and across our borders. So 90% of the cocaine that comes into the United States comes up that traffic route, one way or the other. And then you can see what we're seeing starting to happen also. And this is a very recent event over the last 2 to 3 years, where now the traffic is starting to come out through other portions of Latin America. A year ago, when I talked with my contemporaries in the region, especially the southern part of South America, they didn't see an issue. Now they are seeing an issue across the board, and they're seizing significant amounts of cocaine where they can. But you see, Brazil is now the number two user, because what the traffickers have done is they don't pay in cash for transiting their goods. They pay in drugs. And so they pay in kind, and now those users have to go find in-country recipients to use that drug. And they deal in the highly addictive drugs. There's a drug called Paco, derivative of cocaine. It's kind of like crack in the United States, only it's more addictive and it's more destructive to brain and human body. So it's a very, very bad drug, but that's what's popular and cheap in that part of the world. So you can see the changes that are happening. So now coming up through Africa into Europe to those markets, as I talked about, and what we see now is 60% of the cocaine produced in the northern part of South America comes into the United States. 38% goes to Europe and other places. And that's been a change. The markets in Europe and Middle East are becoming more lucrative. So this is a significant impact. And from my standpoint, there are too many of us in the United States who don't see it as an issue. We don't see the use of drugs, and we don't see the connection that it makes back through this entire region. The homicide rate in Panama has increased by 80% in the last year. A lot of it is gang on gang, but it's happening all through Central America. It's all part of this. Now, the one thing I forgot to mention is, I look at this, it's not a one-way street, it's a two-way street. So weapons are coming south, dollars are coming south. We're seeing bulk cash, but we're seeing a lot of other things to do that. So all those globalized and information things and systems that have helped business be more productive, they've also helped these folks move their product and move their capability. So you can tell it's one of those things that I'm very concerned about because of the impact it has on our region. Now, it is not a military responsibility. Most of this falls to law enforcement. Our job is primarily in the Caribbean and in the Eastern Pacific. We get information from local law enforcement, and then we detect and track vessels, either on the surface or in the air, to where we can then hand them off to law enforcement, U.S. Coast Guard, or local law enforcement to then intercept and detain and prosecute. So the interagency process that we use is critical to the way we do business. So here's our focus. I've talked a lot about that. You understand the concern I have. And in fact, just to show you how innovative the traffickers are, I don't know if you've seen it, but about a month ago in Ecuador, close to the Colombian border, they discovered a fully submersible submarine, or what we call self-propelled, fully submersible vessel made out of fiberglass that makes it very difficult to detect. $4 million built in the jungles, can carry 10 tons of cocaine, can travel 3,000 miles. It could go out around the Galapagos and up to Mexico. So it's a very difficult issue, but it shows how much and how lucrative the business is. We focus on a lot of joint training, and we've talked about that. That's just interacting and staying involved with our partners there, sharing our expertise, learning from them, attending their schools, they're attending our schools, and there's great relationships that happen there. We help support the peacekeeping operations of these militaries as they support peacekeeping operations throughout the world. And I'll talk about one of those that impacts the region significantly, and then humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. So overall, that's a real broad brush of what we in the United States Southern Command do on a day-to-day basis. We only have about 5,000 people assigned to us from an operating force standpoint. A lot of those people, about half of them, are involved with the counter narcotics trade. The other mission we have is we run the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. And so we're responsible for just managing that. So the safe, transparent, legal care of all those detainees. And I'll tell you, you can be very, very proud of the men and women who execute that mission, because it is not an easy mission. And they do it to exacting standards, and they do it very, very well. So we have about 2,000, a little over that, involved in conducting that mission. So with that, because we're talking about humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, let me talk about Haiti. January 12th, and I'll be honest with you, this was not an issue I thought I was going to have to deal with, an earthquake in Haiti. The last earthquake in Haiti was 150 years ago. So that was not on anybody's screen, if you will, of what was going to happen. A 7.3 earthquake about 10 miles from Haiti, fairly shallow, very poor construction there, and a lot of people, cement ceilings or roofs were very important in Haiti. It was a sign of wealth, but it was also, because they dealt with hurricanes, it kept everybody dry. It was you know, keep your roofs from blowing away when hurricanes would come in. So cement roofs were very a very big requirement. But in an earthquake, it was a bad requirement. And so you see the impact, 220 killed, that's an estimate, many injured. A lot of people had also crush injuries. So you see a lot of amputees, a lot of crush injuries, because the wisdom in Haiti was, if there's an earthquake, you stand against the wall. And so when walls crashed, they did too. Roughly, the population of Haiti is 9 million people. So roughly 3 million, a third of the population, was impacted. Think of that in the United States, 100 million people impacted. That's about the equivalent if you look at Haiti. Of that, within Port-au-Prince and the environments there, about initially about 600,000 people displaced. Now that number is 1.5 million, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. So that's the overall situation we came into. I think it's important to understand the primary port is here at Port-au-Prince, supplies 90% of the goods. Sounds familiar to Alaska, right? Road networks were fairly rudimentary. Yeah, this is another port up here, but it's a two-lane highway. It would take, on a good day, 8 to 12 hours to transit from that port to Port-au-Prince. One airport, really, in the country to provide supplies. The tower was disrupted, the port was damaged. And so trying to get relief efforts in was a significant undertaking. I'll just briefly talk about this, but by the end of January, so this is two and a half weeks later, we had this kind of capacity in Haiti. And what really helped our response out very deliberately was the president saying, do what it takes to make this relief effort work. And so all the agencies of the United States government were all focused on providing relief. So we had up to 22,000 people. We had 19 ships afloat. We had over 80 airplanes, a lot of them just people flowing capability in and out, as well as a lot of rotary wing capability. We had a hospital ship. We had actually two expeditionary strike groups, the large deck amphibious marine and helicopter vessels. We had an aircraft carrier there, the USS Carl Vinson, for about 3 weeks because it provided us a helicopter platform. We didn't know what the infrastructure was like on Haiti. We didn't want to burden that infrastructure. The best way to do that was to keep it offshore, and we had the capacity to do that. And actually, that ship got there within about 4 days with helicopters from the earthquake. And so you can see all that. There were actually 7 Coast Guard cutters. The Coast Guard stays there in a routine basis just because of the potential for migration. So they were actually the first responders, like they are in a lot of parts of our country. So you see, we only put about 7,000 people on the ground overall. A lot of that was to support humanitarian assistance and the security for that. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But you can see the significant effort that we put into relief support to Haiti. And there were a lot of other international organizations as well as the United States who really provided a lot of capability. I think it's significant, and I've forgotten the exact number, but using just cell phones, the United States garnered about $50 million in donations just by people donating using their cell phones. So new technology has really improved the ability to move and that capability. Let me put out one other thing while I'm thinking about it as far as response to relief efforts like this. What USAID will ask for almost routinely is send us money, don't send us goods. Because you don't know what the needs of the people are going to be when you're providing that relief effort. And so money provides them with the latitude to meet the needs of the country, of the people they're going in to support, better than trying to ship in goods. I think it's important, and we talked about peacekeeping, but the UN has had a peacekeeping mission in Haiti since 2004. It's led by the Brazilians. They have the primary size of the force, but it has an international flavor from Jordan to Sri Lanka to 8 of the Latin American countries, about 8,000 people. Security was provided by this organization throughout the crisis. A lot of people say it was the United States. We never provided security. We helped support humanitarian assistance, but we didn't provide that security. And you can see they're throughout the country. There's also about 8,000 to 9,000 Haitian National Police. The UN had 100 of its people killed during the earthquake, to include its senior representative, as well as the number 2 military person in the country, or his wife was killed in this earthquake. And so their response was significant. If you look at, and it's something to consider here, if you look at the Haitian National Police, everybody was impacted by this. Everybody's families were impacted, their houses were impacted, everything was there. So where's the priority? How do you do that? Is it taking care of your families, or is it doing the job that you need to do? And so they were actually very, very good, have a lot of capability and a lot of capacity, and reported and did a marvelous job. Just a real quick, a couple of responses. This is the airport in Port-au-Prince. It does not have a parallel taxiway. It only has this entry onto the ramp. On a normal day before the crisis, 20 flights a day, really a little bit less than that, 12 flights a day. These guys came in, that's air traffic control in Haiti after the crisis, guys on a card table, no radar, and they took that from 20 flights a day to a height of 160 flights per day. Now that's all kinds of airplanes, and that's also not including 200 flights of helicopters like these ones that were taking relief goods from here out to where they were needed in the city. So a pretty significant effort if you look at the ability to do that, and they set that up and had it operating within 24 hours. And that lasted until 19 February, when the airport was turned back over to the Haitians. Now, I say that we were invited in by the Haitians to conduct that operation and change that. So this was not us coming in and doing it unilaterally. It was the desire of the Haitian government to do that. This is a look at the port. That's the container part of it. It was completely destroyed. There was another pier that was largely destroyed as well. So the pier and the capability was unusual. That's one of the reasons we brought in the Marine Corps, was because of the capability to move goods across shore. We weren't sure what other kinds of capability were there. Actually, we found commercial capability and capacity that helped us. And there is a capability within the United States military called Joint Logistics Over the Shore that provides us with the ability of ships, and they can come and bring lighterage and capability to put in docks and capability to move goods across the shore. And that's kind of what you see here, kind of a pontoon wharf, if you will, that allowed us to move product across the shore. We also found a commercial capability that came in and put some piers, temporary piers in there, if you will. They're like barges, like you see there, that allowed us to move stuff there, and that is still there. And then our Navy repairmen went and spent about 2 months, and they took the pier that had been largely damaged and in aftershocks was damaged even more and rebuilt it. And it took them about 2 months to do that. So it provided a lot of capacity. So the capacity of the port is now better than it was before the earthquake, and it still hasn't been rebuilt. And then you see just an image of what the destruction was like in downtown Port-au-Prince. So navigating around roads was difficult in a large portion. And you could find buildings that were intact, and right next to it was a building that was pancaked. So it was a significant effort to move around. That's why helicopters became important, and that's why you see a lot of people talking about rubble removal and rubble management in Haiti right now. There's a significant amount of rubble that has to get moved and has to be done something with so that you can rebuild, and that's an ongoing effort. This is a list of the accomplishments. I'll let you just take a little bit to read it. The bottom line to it is, from my standpoint, a lot of the lessons and things that our men and women have done in Iraq and Afghanistan and working with local populaces and understanding how to deal with mayors and understand what their needs and capabilities are came in invaluable in Haiti. They didn't know the Haitian culture. They didn't know the Haitian people. They didn't know the leadership. But our men and women on the ground knew who they needed to talk to, how they needed to talk to them, and how they needed to care for them. And they made a significant difference in our ability to support and understand where the issues and concerns were. We are still there. This is a busy chart, but what this says is we're still training with the Coast Guard there. And the Coast Guard, from a U.S. military standpoint, is the only people we train with because there is no military in Haiti. So it's only a national police force. We have a medical ship that will be in the region throughout the hurricane season. We do that just because we want to have the ability to respond. Actually, it's not a hospital ship like you saw there. It's one of those large deck amphibious ships that has significant medical capability on it, has some Marines on it also. They'll be around the region conducting medical readiness training. It's some of the things similar to what we do here, what the Air Force does here and the Army does here, to go to villages where they provide expertise in deploying, but it provides care to folks there. We have about 500 people in one of the cities in Haiti building schools, providing that medical readiness capability as well. And then we continue to work with the ministries and building emergency ops centers capability and those things. So we, from a U.S. military standpoint, are still very committed there, but it's in the recovery effort, it really transitions to United States Agency for International Development is the one really focused on recovery because they're the ones, they're the experts at it. Some lessons. Situational awareness. Very, very hard to get whenever any disaster happens because you just don't know what you don't know. And it was more difficult there just because of the situation. There's no emergency management system, if you will. There's no normal communication system. Cell phones. Cell phones and cell towers became critical to doing that, interestingly enough. So one of the lessons I learned with that is get the cell towers up as soon as you can, because that's how we all communicate. Same thing throughout the world now. So got the cell towers up. And when we started getting tweets out of people who were in damaged buildings, who we didn't know that they were there prior to that. So it really starts providing a lot of capability there. But an organization and capability, the ability to get that situational awareness is critical so that you know how and where and what to respond. Unity of effort. I bring that up because If you look at this from an international standpoint, not only is it working with all across all parts of U.S. government, but it's working internationally with the U.N., with different branches of the U.N., with a lot of international partners who are coming in providing bilateral support. And it's a lot of coordination that happens needs to happen there, but everybody comes in with their own way of doing business. So working that unity of effort and a lot of focus in building forums and capability to do that is significant also. Sharing information. We had not done this before, but we developed a SharePoint portal that everybody could put information on so that there was one source where we could connect the dots. For example, you heard a lot during the response of medical problems and overcrowded hospitals. Well, there were some hospitals that weren't overcrowded, but nobody knew where they were until we started this SharePoint portal. And now we started finding that capability and we're able to move that around. But it's one of those things you got to do on a routine basis because sharing of information is critical. The other thing from a United States military standpoint, we don't like sharing everything in an unclassified forum. Well, we did that here. Everything we did was all in unclassified forum, so everybody knew what everybody else was doing, and it paid great benefits. Logistics balance. Now, that's my term. I put it on the table because a lot of times response to humanitarian assistance and disaster relief is a logistics problem. It's how do you get the goods there? How do you make that happen? But it's the balance of what goods do you need? When do you need them there? Is there somebody to take them from the port to where they need to be? Is there the capacity to move that? And if you get it out of balance, now you can clog ports. You can clog a lot of different places all along this system and really slow down the response rather than keep it going. So you got to keep that always in balance and look at it as you're addressing it. And it is not a small challenge. It is a significant challenge. And then finally, strategic communications, letting people know what you're doing and how they can help. And that's a constant battle. And it just has to be taken on as one of those things that is part of the relief operation and not a secondary thought. So those are kind of the overall thoughts that we have on that. And the bottom line to it is, it was all focused on supporting the people of Haiti. And so we're very proud of the effort that we made in that endeavor. And so we have a lot of interesting things going on in the United States Southern Command. Haiti was just one of those. It's a great region. It's a place that is important to the United States. And I just ask you to just keep part of your eye as you look east-west. And I know from living up here, there's a lot of focus in the Pacific. But we live in a globalized world. And those connections are around every place we go. And so we got to keep all those pieces in mind. And with that, I'll be happy to entertain any questions. Bill.
There's a lot of people living in the tent. Are they having problems feeding the population? How do they feed them?
The World Food Program, and the World Food Program is a pretty significant organization, and they provide food in a lot of places all over the world. So the World Food Program came in, and they're the ones who provided a significant effort to do that. It was a situation that they had not faced, I think they will tell you in their experiences, because they'd never been in a situation where they had the numbers of people who required assistance in a urban environment. And so the ability to move and get enough product and get it there in a timely manner was a significant endeavor. And so they tend to work a program where they try and move as much food as they can to last for 2 weeks for families. They normally give it to women and children, vice men, because they find if they give it to the women and children that it gets distributed on an even fashion and it doesn't get hoarded and used otherwise. And that's a worldwide experience they have. So today, the food is pretty readily available. One of the concerns they have now is they put enough out that it's impacted the local economy. And so how do you measure what food you're providing, yet get the local economy back going. And so that's a significant issue that everybody is dealing with within Haiti right now. And it's also one of the reasons that you've seen the displaced population grow from about 600,000 to 800,000 to 1.5 million. Because in some cases, if you apply and use UN humanitarian standards for relief, that's a higher standard than a large part of Haiti has been living at. And so that standard's easier and more secure and more food available, medical care available in the camps than it is on the normal populace. So it's had an abnormal effect. And so those are, as you look at the relief efforts in Haiti, there's a lot of different dynamics that are working there that don't meet the eye when you just come in and see it from a day-to-day basis. Yes, sir.
Since we're recording this, please wait for the microphone to come to you.
And then there's one in the back, too.
How do you go about interdicting weapons exports from the United States, and is there any other material that's exported from the United States that comes under your jurisdiction, as opposed to illegal?
You're talking illicit
exports. Yeah.
The illicit weapons, we really look at it, again, within our mission, as we've been given to do. And our mission is fairly defined, and that's the detection and monitoring of illicit trafficking within the maritime environments. For us, that really reads the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific. So what's that mean? It doesn't matter whether a vessel's going north or it's going south. If it's suspect of having illicit goods or conducting illicit business, then we look to stop it. So it may be bulk cash, it may be weapons, it may be drugs. We may or may not know what it is when we detain it. So we just look for the illicit activity.
You mentioned that the Southern Command is in charge of Guantanamo and that we should be proud of the work that's being done there. I'm wondering that, based on the fact that the majority of people held there were innocent and detained without charge, and people like Binyam Muhammad, a British citizen who had his testicles sliced, Sami Al-Haj, a Sudanese citizen who was a photographer for Al Jazeera, was brutally beaten and detained, held without charge, released without charge. That's happened to countless others. What about that should we be proud of?
Our men and women are charged with maintaining that securing capability there. And I think if you go and see what they are doing, they're maintaining the standards that the UN mandates, and that standard is being there. From a policy issue and all the rest of that, we're the ones who instigate or manage the facilities to the capacities that the UN requires us to do in the international environment. And that's the standard to which we're leaving. And in fact, the International Red Cross comes and oversees the operation and conduct on a quarterly basis. And so we work very directly with them.
I'd like to ask a question on a topic you touched on, but get a little more information. You mentioned that the success of some of the interdiction efforts had caused the traffickers to shift to other regions. I'd heard of some experts a few weeks ago saying that one of the things that's fueling the drug violence in Mexico is actually the fact that Colombia's been a success. And you had said that NORTHCOM has responsibility for Mexico. So I'm wondering if you could just comment on whether you think that the successes in Colombia have in fact affected Mexico, and if so, what can SOUTHCOM do to coordinate with NORTHCOM to try to resolve those issues?
I treat and look at illicit trafficking as a region, and more importantly, becoming a global enterprise. And so how you interdict and how you affect it in one place can affect what happens in another part of the region. For example, Colombia has been reducing the level of cocaine production, and so the traffickers have shifted to other parts. Peru is growing in the production of coca leaf and cocaine. Bolivia is seeing an increase in the production. And so, as what we're seeing is also some of the drug trafficking organizations have changed more from a Colombian focus to a Mexican drug trafficking organization. And so they are starting to move south into Central America as well. So yes, any time you push on one place and don't have the ability to deter them from going to another place, they will go to where the location of least resistance is so that they can continue to conduct their business in the manner in which they choose and want to do that. We have a very close relationship with Northern Command. So there is not a seam. We work with them as we look at the southern border between Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize on how we can help support the efforts there. We combine our efforts and we meet on a regular basis. Our staffs talk on a routine basis as we work that issue. So it's really a combined effort, and it involves a lot of other organizations within the United States government also, not just U.S. Southern Command and U.S. Northern Command.
You touched on the issue of narco trafficking morphing into philosophical differences and other, what we call terrorism, I should say. And I'm wondering if you could expand that a little bit. I'm not really clear about how that's happening as far as the narcotics terrorism would morph. I hate that
okay.
word, but.
Yeah. Let me use the FARC in Colombia as probably the best example. They started out as very much an ideological-based organization, not happy with the government, the capability of Colombia, and were looking to undermine that government. As the Colombians and the United States has been supporting their efforts over the last 10 years, as that has improved and that has pushed on the FARC, it's hurt their ability to gain support from other ideological groups who support them or others, and so they've used the illicit trafficking as a means for gaining funds to conduct their operations. And so that's the connection that we see in many cases as you go to a narco-terrorist organization is one that's using illicit trafficking to fund their ideological activities, if you will. The line gets very blurry, though, as I talked about, as you look at gangs, as you look at illicit traffickers, you look at their efforts to undermine. Some of them use terrorist-like activities. For example, I was in Guatemala last week. On the day I was there, there were 8 shootings on city buses in the city on that day, looking to extort the bus drivers. Now that's more gang-related, but it's also illicit trafficking-related. So, again, the lines of and the practices kind of blur between the two of them. There are a couple of designated terrorist organizations within the region, Hamas and Hezbollah. They have elements of their organizations within the region. They primarily provide financial support to their parent organizations back in the Middle East. But we're watching that just because of the connection and the ability of illicit traffickers. If you can move 1,000 metric tons of cocaine across the U.S. border a year, if you can move a lot of people across the U.S. border every year, there is the potential that an organization can use that to their benefit. I don't see that right now, but I'm paid to be skeptical.
General, do you see any, or do you have any partnering going on with Venezuela right now? And how do you deal with issues between a country like Venezuela and Colombia?
We do not have any partnership ongoing right now with Venezuela. Their choice, not ours. We continue to invite them to exercises. We continue to invite them to conferences. We have a liaison position at this Joint Interagency Task Force South, which conducts our counter drug activities. They have chosen not to engage with us, but we would still look for those opportunities to do that. And so our approach to everyone within the region is we're looking to build partnerships. And from my standpoint, the real threat that we face is what I talked about. It's the illicit trafficking issue. It's not the traditional nation-on-nation conventional military concerns. So I'm looking to build the partnerships to address the adversary that we have today rather than the one that has been a historic norm for a lot of countries.
Are you aware of how the international medical groups are doing that have been working on helping with the resistant TB and the other types of projects like that to help with the health in the group? I didn't know how they were affected because it was a very strong project going on in Haiti and Peru. Were they able to continue with their medical delivery and stuff for the medications?
I don't know about Peru. Haiti, there has been a pretty significant effort that's ongoing post-crisis also. I don't remember the exact number, but they have inoculated a significant number of the young, of the children within Haiti against disease. So that's had a pretty significant impact, at least that's our assessment, because there hasn't been any outbreaks of serious disease within Haiti during the crisis. And so that's been a significant effort. So there's probably in some cases now better medical capacity in Haiti post-earthquake than there was pre-earthquake.
I think we have time for one more question.
Regarding the possibility of conventional warfare within Latin America, isn't it the case that the democratic nation of Venezuela does face a military threat, a conventional military threat from Colombia, based on some unproven allegations that some FARC militants are being allowed to harbor in Venezuela?
I do not see that they face a military threat. Venezuela face a military threat from Colombia. The Colombians are focused on addressing the FARC, and they're concerned about that because that's been the significant effort that they've been undertaking over the last 10 years. And so from my standpoint, the concern that the Colombians have is the fact of if there are places where the FARC can operate and there's not the ability to address that, then that's a concern. And so UNASUR, in 2008, made an agreement amongst all their partners, and that's a conference of all the South American nations, that they would not support illicit activities within their borders. And so that's the issue that's going on right now, I see, between Colombia and Venezuela. And so it's a serious matter, and from a United States government standpoint, it ought to be investigated. Well, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure talking with you today. And thanks for all your support.
Thanks very much, General Frazier. And as a token of our appreciation today, you know, a lot of times we have speakers, it's their first time in Alaska, and we present them with a picture book. But this is not your first time in Alaska. So instead, we'll present you with the coveted Alaska World Affairs Council clip pin and one of our new thermos mugs.
All right. Thank you very much.
That concludes our presentation for today. The next presentation will be next Friday, July 30th. It'll be a lunch presentation. It'll be a panel discussion between General Duvall, the Deputy Commander of North American Aerospace Defense Command, and General Atkins, the Commander of 11th Air Force in Alaska NORAD region. And it's going to be on NORAD partners in defense for the next 50 years. So we hope to see you then. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the opportunity.